Radiotopia.
You didn't hear this from me, but Normal Gossip is back for a sixth season. Join host Kelsey McKinney as she shares the juiciest gossip from the real world. Each episode, she's joined by a special guest, and you might recognize a couple this season from the Radiotopia universe. Normal Gossip, named one of the best podcasts of the year by Time Magazine and Vulture, is out now on all your favorite podcast platforms. New episodes starting April 17th.
Dear Diary.
Sixth grade.
February 14th.
1991.
I am really depressed.
How could she break up with me?
Mom, you can't read this.
Okay, but I was always kind of obsessed with food. What I am going to eat if and when I lose weight. Homemade chocolate chip cookies, strawberry malts, fudge, Oreos, glazed donuts, peanut M&Ms, Reese's. Everything will be okay.
That's Mary Jo Pell. You may know her as Pearl Forrester from the original Mystery Science Theater 3000. And when Mary Jo was growing up, she daydreamed about getting access to her favorite foods.
I have this fantasy about being locked in a grocery store or deli overnight. I'd go berserk. I'd bring a few necessities such as plates, portable oven, silverware. I'd be sick, of course, but I think it may be worth it.
For the record, hell yes, it would be worth it. In fact, I'd be totally lying if I said I hadn't had similar fantasies, and still do. But given the chance to eat your favorite foods until you got sick to your stomach is something most teenagers would probably turn down. And not because they don't want to raid the candy aisle, but because they've suddenly hit that age where everyone is totally consumed by appearances. From PRX and Radiotopia, this is the Mortified Podcast. I'm Neil. And today, we explore the lengths kids go to fit in, even when we're convinced we don't fit the ideal image. What we wore, what we ate, and what we hope to hide.
I never had a flat stomach even when I was a little kid. I had like a tank, like torso. But yeah, no, I don't think I was probably actually overweight. And so at a time when physical appearance is becoming so important in adolescence, I looked really different.
When she entered seventh grade, Jessie Conrady wasn't just worried about her midsection.
Being 5'9 in middle school is the equivalent of being like Chewbacca, hanging out with a whole bunch of Ewoks. I feel like I could carry them. I felt like I was gigantic, like Godzilla.
And Jessie wasn't the only one who used pop culture references to describe her body.
I got made fun of a lot by, not so much by people in my class, but by my brothers. So they would like sing my weight. Like there's a local radio station, 106 KMEL, that's still around. So I had told my brother that I weighed 106 pounds. I was probably 10. It was like 106 KMEL.
But then Jessie thought if her brothers use comedy to make her feel worse, she could use comedy to feel better.
Like I said, puberty was rough on me and my body was changing in ways that I didn't like. So I dealt with this in the way that most 13-year-old girls deal with it. I wrote songs, pop songs in my room and performed choreography in my room and looked at, and watched myself in the mirror like I was in a music video. Normal stuff. So this is one of the songs I wrote to the tune of a Britney Spears song you might recognize. The song is called Fit Me, Baby, One More Time. Oh, baby, baby, how was I supposed to know that my clothes would shrink in size, yeah. Oh, baby, baby, I shouldn't have let myself grow. Cause now my clothes are tiny. Show me how big that they should be. Tell me, baby, cause I need to know now. Oh, because my size 10 is killing me. And I must confess, I can't believe that now I can't wear the clothes that I loved. Give me that size. Fit me, baby, one more time.
You know, I still felt insecure. It didn't take it away, but it made it funny. The feeling lingered because I think it's dysmorphia. You know, I make an assumption about the way that I look based on how I feel instead of being able to see what my body looks like from the outside and judging myself based on that. I will always be the slightly awkward tall girl in my mind.
While Jessie was obsessed with her measurements, other kids were obsessed with the numbers that appeared on the scale. And for many of us, there are a few things more depressing than using those numbers as a way to measure ourselves up against our peers.
My name is Lori. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. And growing up, I was the kind of kid who took everything very seriously. From worrying about my grades, especially math, to worrying about my weight, to dissecting any comment that anyone ever made about me. Going through my eighth grade was like being in a minefield. So when I turned 14, I decided I was going to change things around. And I thought I would do so by losing just 17 pounds. All my dreams would come true. So I went about my weight loss in kind of an unconventional way as a teenager in the 90s. I joined the 45 and better crowd in the basement of a church for weekly Weight Watchers meetings. This is my story. Dear Diary, I slipped on lunch. I had one chicken finger, two fried mushrooms, two potato skins, one mozzarella stick, and a handful of fries. Oops. 2 days later, Dear Diary, yes, I got a B- in math. Go, Lori, go, Lori. Today is Weight Watchers. Wish me luck. I hope that I lost weight. Yes, I lost 2.5 pounds. Go, Lori. I am so excited. 14 more to go. Then I will be truly happy. 2 days later, Dear Diary, Jay is such a fucking bastard. Yesterday, Aaron was talking to Michael at Jay's, and there was a truck outside, and someone goes, what's that? And he goes, it's Lori. Yeah. Well, Aaron yelled at him, and he goes, I can say it, I'm her cousin. And he had the nerve to go on the bus. Lori, how was your day? I go, shut up, jerk. He goes, what did I do? Julie goes, she's real pissed at you, and told him why. It's none of her damn business. The bitch is gonna tell everyone. I think I'm gonna hide out in my room. I lost 3.5 pounds too. I am so fat, I hate myself.
I had outside influences of people telling me that I was chubby, and like my parents wanted me to lose weight to make sure that I would fit in socially and that I wouldn't have issues with dating and that, you know, that I would look good and that I would be attractive to other people.
Dear Diary, well, the wonderful weekend's over. It wasn't so wonderful. The one part that sticks out in my mind was when I was sleeping at Anna's and I hugged her and she grabbed part of my back and goes, look at all that fat. I almost cried. Then she goes, Lori, feel my fat, come on. Like the bitch has fat. No, I love her and all, but geez, have some tact. I think I'm depressed. My life's in a rut. Why don't guys like me? I'm not a dog, am I? And the guys that like me, like that sweetie Brian from camp, why can't they be cute? Even I have my standards. If anybody ever reads this, my life is in deep shit. One week later, Dear Diary, I had the worst day. It started off not bad. I semi-talked to Julie. I told her I was mad when she kept going, you can make yourself happy. Don't pull my dick, bitch. In parentheses, it says, I love that saying. I went back to Dr. Bob, and I hate him. He looked at my bra front and back, felt my private part, and told me I better not gain any more weight. Like the back house should talk, I hate him. That's all, gotta go.
The closest I ever got to my goal weight was like 7 pounds away. I feel like I look back now and I look at my 20s and my teens and I looked great and I was so hard on myself and I have two daughters now and I have a goal of not raising them that way, you know, and hoping to instill in them that they're valuable, wonderful, smart, awesome human beings and not making it about a number. But that being said, I'm doing Weight Watchers again, and it's something that's just, I think it's just a fabric of my being at this point. I've been doing this for 25 years.
So Lori never reached her goal weight, and she's okay with that. In retrospect, having a number you want to hit isn't always a healthy thing, because you can easily neglect all the intangibles that make one's weight such a loaded topic. And when that happens, the need to weigh a certain amount or look a certain way can be overwhelming.
I published my diaries in a book called Stick Figure, A Diary of My Former Self.
That's licensed psychotherapist and New York Times bestselling author, Lori Gottlieb.
I really wanted to publish that because they were my actual diaries, which I thought was important. So it wasn't me looking back many years later on the experience. It was actually, here's what happens in the mind of somebody who seems like a normal kid who all of a sudden goes on this extreme diet that turns into a life-threatening illness. I felt like they were the kind of things that people aren't talking about, and I really wanted to bring them out and share them in a live space where people could react immediately to the material. I think that most things in life aren't all funny or all sad. I think that the things that are sad can also be funny, and the things that are funny can also be sad. And that's sort of the fabric of life. And I feel like, you know, if you're really going to honestly tell your story, there's going to be the funny parts, the sad parts, and everything in between.
Just a quick note of caution. The following journal entries contain some pretty intense moments, and they may be triggers for anyone who's dealt with an eating disorder.
I'm Lori, and I grew up in Beverly Hills, where everybody was very obsessed with their bodies and how thin they were. When I got my diary when I was 11, thought that I was sort of the only sane person in this very insane world. So here I am writing about what happened with my best friend, Julie. Julie's mom is always on some new diet, but if you want my opinion, she never looks like she's losing any weight. Her stomach is total blubber, but the rest of her is super skinny, like those pictures of starving kids in Africa with the fat belly and the skinny legs. Except Julie's mom also has a turkey chin. Personally, I don't think a diet is gonna help her.
We didn't learn a lot about nutrition. We learned more about appearance. So I would hear our moms talking about, oh, I can't eat that because, you know, I'll get fat. So the kids could eat dessert, but the moms never ate dessert. But once you become a certain age as a woman, then all of a sudden these things are kind of forbidden. The girls were sort of competitive with each other around their bodies. And I think that they got that messaging from the adult women who were around them who, you know, it's not their fault. That's just how they grew up and then how they developed as women. When you are in the middle of an eating disorder, you can, you know, weigh nothing and think that you're fat.
And while many of us were staring at the scale every day, Lori was weighing her food down to the crumb.
I was very goal-oriented. So if I set my mind to something, I was going to do it. And not only was I going to do it, but I was going to be the best at it. And so when it came to dieting, I decided that I was going to be the best. And what that turned into was basically, how can I eat the least amount of food in a day, every day? My whole life was focused on my food and counting calories. I don't even want to breathe the air where I'm smelling food because I'm worried that the calories are going to come into me through the air.
So then a few months later, I became anorexic. In fact, I starved myself so much that I ended up at the pediatric ward at Cedars-Sinai Hospital. So they got a psychiatrist to come in, and he came up with a plan that he thought would help me to see how skinny I really was. And in this next entry, I weigh less than 60 pounds. Dear Diary, Today, Dr. Gold told me that he's decided to film me. I'm serious, like in a movie. Dr. Gold wants to film me so I can take a good look at myself. I told Dr. Gold that all I do all day is look at myself. That's how I know I'm fat, duh. But he just said that seeing myself in a movie would make me look different. Dr. Gold told me they'll probably film me tomorrow so I can be used as a case study. That means that other doctors will watch it to learn about anorexia. Then Dr. Gold said that I'm an excellent case, which is why they picked me in the first place. I guess that means I'm an excellent dieter. That's why I'm not eating anything until after the filming tomorrow. Not one bite. I couldn't sleep last night because I was so excited about starring in my anorexia movie and becoming the most famous anorexic in the country. I had only one sip of orange juice since yesterday, so I'd look like an excellent case. But when Dr. Gold came in today, he didn't have a movie camera like I expected. He was only carrying his stupid notepad. He said he decided not to do the movie with me after all. I tried to tell him that I'm an excellent case, and I even told him that I'm such an excellent case that I didn't even eat anything since yesterday, not one bite. But Dr. Gold said that was exactly why he wouldn't film me. He said I got too excited about it, and it would just make me happy about being too skinny. What a liar. I'll bet the real reason that he changed his mind is because I'm too fat for the movie. But really, it's my own fault. I mean, I never should have had that sip of orange juice.
So I did start eating in the hospital, and I did start eating after that. And it was really in the hospital that it occurred to me, and I really realized how serious things had gotten, and also just how, you know, losing weight was not making me happy. In fact, it was making me miserable. And I was missing everything. I wasn't even at school. I was missing out on everything. And everybody else was moving on with their lives. And I was basically forgotten. And I was, you know, sitting in a hospital room in the end of fifth grade. You know, you're surrounded by kids who are dying of diseases that, you know, that are not of their own making, whereas mine was. And I think that that was, you know, and people died who were around me. And I think that that was a real wake-up call that, wait, what am I doing to myself? Why am I doing this? I was fortunate in that my anorexia was very short-lived. I used to run groups with body image and eating disorders. And I also, in my private practice, I see people frequently who have either a diagnostic eating disorder or they just struggle with body image and food issues in their lives. To hear what somebody actually went through and to know that so many people go through this and have, you know, the specifics might be different, but it takes away the shame, it takes away the stigma, and it allows people to open up and start these conversations in their own families.
And feeling like you'll never live up to some ideal or being too afraid to talk about it is not exclusive to girls.
I think my heaviest weight was probably 260 or 280. In early high school, I knew it was a problem because I felt different. It was a problem that I was bigger than the other boys. It was a problem that I didn't feel like I had the normal athletic body that other boys had. It was a problem that I didn't feel like, even in second grade, I had crushes on girls, but I didn't think they would like me because I was fat.
Being overweight as a kid was a problem Matt Shepard had to deal with on a daily basis.
I got called the Pillsbury Doughboy. I had kids that would grab my boobs and like tell me I had man boobs. I mean, I got poked and prodded and touched and called names probably every day for a good 4 years.
Eventually, Matt overcame bullying to gain some popularity in high school, but feeling insecure about his appearance never went away.
Like some of my senior pictures, like I was involved, so I was in a lot of pictures, so I would hide in the pictures. I got senior superlative most dramatic, and in the picture, it's me behind a curtain poking my head out. That's what I did.
Around that same time, Matt started keeping a journal. In his senior year, he had a girlfriend, decent grades, he was in clubs, but those topics rarely came up in his writings.
January 8th, 2002, 235 pounds. Today, I've decided I'm going to reclaim myself. I will begin to eat healthy. February 24th, 2002, tomorrow I'm going to get up and go to the gym, I can do it. October 24th, 2002. Well, today I did a little bit better with everything. I did the gym for about 25 minutes. My eating wasn't too bad. Also, I realize I just can't worry so much. I even worry about getting mugged. I need to get up and go to the gym in the morning. This is what I need to do. I have to just do it. I have to follow through with my dreams.
And this pattern of dwelling almost exclusively on getting in better shape continued after graduation. Even when Matt was surrounded by people who didn't know him when he was getting bullied in middle school.
October 25th, 2002. Well, today I'm feeling pretty lonely. I wouldn't get anybody to go to the haunted house with me, so I went by myself. I think because I am lonely, I ate a lot. In fact, I ate too much. I didn't even go to the gym. I'm slowly getting myself back into a routine, hopefully. The haunted house was a lot of fun, even though I was alone. My head was such a bad place to be in anyways that a haunted house wasn't half as scary. A haunted house was not half as scary as the kind of negative shit that I was telling myself all the time, which was a lot lonelier than going to a haunted house by myself.
The shame Matt was battling in college wasn't new. He'd been battling it his whole life.
When I was in like second grade, when I was at my grandparents' house and she just made a cake, that cake was not for me. It was something that was being made for the family, but I wanted it, even though I wasn't supposed to. And so I cut myself a piece of cake, and I remember going upstairs to eat it, and I was thinking, okay, I'm alone. I can enjoy this piece of cake. And then I heard my mom coming up the stairs, and I knew she would be mad that I ate the cake. So I ran into the bathroom, and I hid it behind the toilet because no one's going to look for a piece of cake behind the toilet. When my mom found the cake, she walked in the room with the cake, and she goes, "Matt." I go, "Yeah." She goes, "What's this? What's going on?" Like, what's this? I didn't really deny it. I just kind of didn't own it. I mean, it's just like, yeah, I did it. Yeah, I put that cake there. I was going to eat it. I mean, what do you do when you're that embarrassed and you're doing irrational things? It's no different than any other addict. You just want to eat. You just want to feel good. And even at that young of an age, it's like I'd want anything to anesthetize myself, anything that would give me a high or a rush that would just kind of check me out.
Stories like Matt's are rarely told in the media, and they act as proof that eating disorders aren't necessarily the result of Barbie dolls or ads with supermodels in them, but something that hits even closer to home.
Growing up, my dad was an alcoholic minister who stopped drinking. My older brother was a drug addict, cool kid who was really popular in school and was the star athlete. My mom was always just trying to keep everybody together and make everything perfect. And my younger brother is bipolar. So being invisible is a pretty good choice. And being really good at school and trying to be an overachiever. I remember my mom telling me, that they were glad I was the one they didn't have to worry about. So inadvertently, I always kind of felt like I was the one that it was my job just not to cause trouble and not get in the way.
After 2 decades of using food to make himself blend into the background, Matt found himself at a point where trying to make himself invisible no longer worked.
I graduated college. I bought a one-way plane ticket to Los Angeles. I'm out here trying to find jobs. No one would hire me. And I'm over 300 pounds. And I reached a point where I was so scared about where I was going to live, how I was going to take care of myself, what I was going to do. My parents didn't have the financial ability to help me. So everything started to come up. And I would be eating. I would binge. I would pay $15 for parking at City Walk. And then I would binge at all those restaurants. And I reached a point where the food stopped working, where I was having so many feelings, so many thoughts, so many fears. My free housing ended. I had a rental car, and I was in a hotel room, and that was it. And I was running out of money, and I was choosing food over taking care of my housing situation. I knew that my money was running out, and I was not going to have that hotel room soon, and I couldn't stop eating. So that's where I was at.
And that's when Matt hit rock bottom. His childhood coping mechanisms had officially failed him. In a moment of reflection, he decided to look back at his high school journal to see where he'd gone wrong.
May 25th, 2006. Well, I fucked up on my eating today. I remember past journals years ago when each day I talked about how shitty I felt about my eating, but I never changed. I'm scared to write about it again because I don't want to have the same problem. To find control over my life is the best thing I can do for myself. I will be hungry, but I must do it. My plans are so big, so vast. I am hungry, but really I am hungry for other things. I must honor the gift God has given me. I must fight for everything it is that I want to do and be. It's not worth anything if I fought for nothing. I must take it a day at a time. God, help my hunger go away. And so for me, it was a surrender of letting go of this idea that I have to control and manage everything. And it was the start of me not trying to exercise to lose weight. It was the start of me not trying to control what I ate because I didn't have control. I never had control. I have a journal that shows examples of years of me not having control. And I had to get to that point where I was that alone and sit with myself to see that. My life now is about proving my old self wrong. And it has come with a lot of hard work. It's come with a lot of recovery, a lot of therapy, and a lot of willingness to just call me out on my own bullshit.
Thanks to all the brave souls who shared their childhood writings with no embellishing, no exaggerating, just God-given awkwardness. And this concludes today's episode, where we learned people are definitely not what they eat. And according to teenage Mary Jo, it's actually way more philosophical than that.
To wit, people are like taco chips. Some have all the spice and powdery stuff, and some have very little. But they are all eventually consumed for their individual worth.
If you or someone you know, especially a teenager, is dealing with an eating disorder, there are lots of great resources out there. Consider reaching out to therapists or support groups in your area or nonprofit organizations like the National Eating Disorders Association. They've actually created a body positive online community just for teens called proudtobeme.org. That's proud, the number two, the letter B, me.org. Check it out. To share the shame, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or visit getmortified.com to learn about Mortified stage shows, books, films, and beyond. Click participate, and who knows, maybe you'll appear on a future episode of this series. And even if you have no ambition to share your old writings with the world, we encourage everyone out there to find something you created as a kid, anything, even stuff that says,
"Don't pull my dick, bitch,"
and share it with just one friend. It's fun, it's scary, and we promise you'll discover something new about yourself in the conversation that follows. Thanks to Matt Shepard and Lori Gottlieb for joining us. You can check out Matt's videos at his YouTube channel at Meet Matt Shep. You can also find Lori Gottlieb's writing, including Stick Figure, at Amazon and bookstores everywhere, and discover her latest, a comedic advice column in New York Magazine called What Your Therapist Really Thinks. As many of you know, the Mortified Podcast is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, which is made possible with support from the Knight Foundation. Thanks to AdZerk for providing their ad-serving platform to Radiotopia. If your company would like to support our podcast, we'd love that. Email sponsor at radiotopia.fm. Our podcast production team for this episode includes Katie McMurrin, Hadley Dion, Dave Nadelberg, and myself, Neil Katcher. Stories were produced for the stage by Shay DeGranis, Annette Ferrara, Katie Cisneros, and Kevin Wofson. Music by Gordon Bash, Alex Burke, Adam Smith, The Angel, Zoe Rose Palladino, and Snakes. A big thanks to Lance Roberts Studios and all the dedicated Mortified Live producers whose work make the stage show possible. Until next time, we remind you that you might be a freak, you may be fragile, but you survive.